This ruling is deeply troubling. The president is firmly committed to protecting and defending the sanctity of marriage. He strongly believes that marriage is a sacred institution between a man and a woman. We are going to be reviewing this decision.
That's Scott McClellan, White House press secretary. He was reacting to the Massachusetts Supreme Court's clarification on whether or not the legislature in the state of Massachusetts could okay same-sex unions instead of full-blown gay marriage. The court said no. Only gay marriage would be constitutional in the state of Massachusetts. Well, this has really gone a step further, and I would say much faster than anyone thought it would. In Vermont, they said, look, same-sex unions, not marriage, same-sex unions. And just about the time everyone was getting used to that, Massachusetts turns around and decides, no, according to the Massachusetts Constitution, if you have marriage for heterosexual couples, you have to have marriage for homosexual couples, and not unions, marriage, full-blown matrimony. The prospect actually exists that at least after May of this year, the state of Massachusetts could be issuing marriage licenses to gay couples. Now, there is some work that the legislature is looking at of amending the Massachusetts Constitution to limit marriage to a man and a woman, which would void those licenses, but that is by no means guaranteed. And that goes to a vote of the people if it manages to make it through the legislature there in Massachusetts. A lot of things to talk about with regard to gay marriage. I am glad at a time like this and in an hour like this that we have Dr. John Warwick Montgomery right alongside. He's professor emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He's a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, a member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's also a distinguished professor of apologetics in the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana. He's author and editor of more than 50 books, including Christians in the Public Square. Dr. Montgomery, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
I must say, just by way of jest, that I'd like to wish you a happy anniversary of the Mexican Constitution.
Well, how delightful. You're the first and indeed the only person who has wished me that.
Probably the last, too, Dr. Montgomery. Your general reaction to the goings-on in the United States, in particular the Massachusetts Supreme Court?
Well, they're out of their minds. They are simply out of their minds. This not only creates immense problems socially, it is a legal bomb thrown into the midst of the federal legal system. It's going to cause incredible problems. And the irony of this is that the whole thing could have been handled as it was handled in Vermont. I mean, the fact is that legally, if you want to associate with someone else on a temporary or permanent basis, you can do this. It's possible to establish a partnership, for example, or if you'd like to make it independent of the lives of the individuals, you can establish a corporation with all kinds of legal protections. So if two people want to live together, that can certainly be protected, such that their property rights are preserved, et cetera, et cetera. But to classify as a marriage, to use the term marriage for a relationship, quasi-permanent, between two people of the same sex, is utterly bizarre. I believe it was Humpty Dumpty who said in Alice in Wonderland, I can use a word any way I want as long as I pay it extra. Now, if you redefine marriage in the way in which the Massachusetts Supreme Court has done so, then the amount you're going to have to pay in terms of social and legal consequences is simply gigantic. They are out of their minds.
But folks, think about this. This is precisely the basis upon which so many people are making the argument for gay marriage. They're arguing that apart from marriage, you can't have hospital visitation rights. Apart from full-blown marriage, you cannot have inheritance rights. You cannot have any other kind of insurance benefits paying off. You cannot have this. You cannot have that. They are seeking through marriage all sorts of things, at least if I hear our guest, Dr. John Warren Montgomery, correctly, that can be had legally through other arrangements other than marriage. So it puts a person to wondering, doesn't it? It makes a person think, why marriage? If these rights, these benefits can be for a couple in a partnership, in a union, in a corporation, there are other legal means of arriving at the same end. Why marriage? Now, we can answer this question. We could answer this question from God's word and say, well, it's just the perversity of sin. And that is, of course, a very good answer. The last argument I heard put forward, and I thought it was just a quiet, silent argument that you didn't hear very often, but now I'm hearing it more and more, is, look, you should want gay marriage, full-blown gay marriage, monogamous marriage with all its rights and privileges. You should want it because otherwise gays will be promiscuous. Otherwise there will be disease spread. Otherwise there will be all sorts of social ills. So a right-thinking person should want gay marriage for the homosexual. Dr. Montgomery, why do homosexuals want marriage and not a partnership or a union or a corporation?
Well, it's symbolic, of course. What they want is the dignity and indeed the sanctity that has been traditionally associated with marriage. The whole point of the homosexual movement is to legitimate this kind of relationship. And the modern history of this has been a history of an extreme minority making up just the barest fraction of civilized society, throwing its weight around and getting a great deal of support from the media. And, of course, the reason for this is that the media are invariably liberal. And the reason that they're invariably liberal is that they are not interested often in reporting news. They're desperate to make it because, as a matter of fact, most of the things that go on are not newsworthy. How can you present news 24 hours a day that is really interesting when there isn't any? Well, you produce it. And so, of course, anything that already exists is not able to offer such possibilities, whereas any lame-brained idea that somebody has that's different from what the status quo represents will offer the possibility of news. So the impression is given in modern Western societies that there are these tremendous numbers of homosexuals around, and that they have got to have sufficient representation, and that their concerns have got to be paid attention to. All of this is false. The fact of the matter is that the number of them is utterly minuscule, and even if it wasn't, for goodness sake, what they're maintaining is utterly bizarre. It is off the wall, and it doesn't deserve legal recognition, to say nothing about social attention.
So is it fair to say, if I'm hearing you correctly, that marriage for the homosexual advocate of gay marriage is a symbol of public acceptance?
Precisely. Well put, as always.
Does something about that troubles me, Dr. Montgomery, that marriage would be used as a symbol of something else and not as an end in itself.
Well, yes, although we must admit that through the centuries, marriage has always had the two functions, the literal function, if you will, the de facto function, but it's also been symbolic. For example, there have been instances where a generation ago, homosexuals would sometimes marry heterosexually without any thought of completing the union, in order to have the prestige that connects with an ordinary marriage. And of course, there are marriages for convenience, which have been used, again and again. Some of the listeners probably saw the film The Green Card with Gérard Depardieu, one of the finest contemporary French actors, and this was the story of someone who was desperate to get married in order to benefit from the American Green Card, from immigration. So I think we simply have to recognize that there are mixed motives involved in any activity. The problem here is, it seems to me, the fundamental problem of whether or not the quasi-permanent relationship between two people of the same sex is a marriage. And the answer is it isn't, unless you want to redefine the term in such a way that, as Humpty Dumpty says, you're going to have to pay it extra.
I would like to talk about where the definition of marriage is derived in just a moment, but I have a line of thought I'd like to pursue just a little bit more here. If we are willing to pay the term more, in Humpty Dumpty's terms, on marriage, and say, okay, marriage will now include two men, have we crossed a threshold from which we cannot return in basically say, well, then we cannot then restrict the term in any way, really? I mean, once we've been willing to expand it that far, it seems as though it's going to stretch farther and farther as time goes by.
Oh, it certainly will. And this is a special case of a much larger issue. In the abortion controversy, the people who have favored abortion have categorically refused to pay any attention to the genetic character of the fetus. They have said that a human being is not a human being because of genetic chromosomal considerations. The person may become a human being by acting in a certain manner. Now, what's going on there is an effort to eliminate any objective definition of the human being. Here, in the gay marriage thing, the idea is to eliminate any genetic definition of what a marriage should properly be. The whole idea in a modern secular society is to relativize everything, to put everything up for grabs. You can define anything any way you want. There are no natural limits on what you're doing. And, of course, the motivation for this is ultimately that you want to be your own God. You want to be able to do what the Lord God commissioned Adam to do in the garden, namely naming everything. But the naming, of course, was in accord with the actual nature of those things. This is simply autonomous secular man wanting to redo the entire universe according to his own will, making himself a god, and of course at the same time destroying himself and destroying the world about him. Because, you know, a mark of maturity is to recognize the way things actually are. That's what we try to get our children to do, so that they won't bang their head on the floor because they don't like the way things are going for them. This whole thing is an example of incredible, incredible social immaturity based directly on sinful, self-centered autonomy.
And if we are willing to pay the term extra when it comes to marriage, is there any real reason why we would stop and then not say, and these couples ought to be able to adopt children, and we will recognize them as full-fledged parents every bit as much as a heterosexual couple that would adopt children or have children of their own?
Well, sure. And after all, why should it stop with marriage between two human beings of the same sex, for example? Suppose I would like to marry an orangutan. If the orangutan doesn't have a good lawyer, it would seem to me that that would be perfectly possible. I mean, once you've eliminated the idea of a man and a woman as the necessary constituents of marriage, why couldn't you eliminate the idea of a human being? After all, in the abortion situation, even though the fetus has all the characteristics of a human being genetically, it is not regarded as a human being. So it would seem to me logically, if I fall in love with an orangutan, you know, or an antelope or a hippopotamus or something of that kind, and I want to engage in bestiality, then I could always say that if I'm not allowed to do this, and if this isn't given social approval by the use of a magic word like marriage, then, of course, I'm being discriminated against. There are absolutely no limits to this kind of thing. Wittgenstein, the great analytical philosopher, said the limits of our language are the limits of our world. Anything that can be said clearly. Therefore, as language deteriorates, so does thinking, and so does any ability to understand the world clearly. This is why a Christian education is so important, or in general, a cultural education. People who are unable to appreciate the force of language are dangerous, and this is a perfect example of it. It is absolutely incredible that the judges of the Massachusetts Supreme Court have declared themselves to be linguistic imbeciles.
I recently had Jennifer Roback Morse on the program, Dr. Montgomery. She has written a book called Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. And she made the point that if heterosexual marriage were what it ought to be legally, she doesn't think it would be such an attractive institution to the homosexual couple, because they certainly don't want marriage as it ought to be. They want marriage as it is, a no-fault divorce, easy in, easy out, an opener system. What do you think of her conclusion there?
Well, that's probably true. You know, in the case of Vermont, where the couples have gotten the license, which is possible in Vermont, though it is not referred to as a marriage, when they have then wanted to break this up, they have found that in other states, the original agreement has not been recognized, and therefore they can't get out of it. And of course, if divorce laws in the United States were in any way reflective of biblical standards, then it would be a great deal harder to get out of anything of this kind than it presently is. I think she has a point that marriage is taken so lightly among the heterosexual secular population that probably the homosexual population figures that they can get all the advantages, and there aren't really very many disadvantages.
I'm a little concerned as well of what the whole situation that Vermont and here comes Massachusetts as well creates for the full faith and credit clause of the U.S. Constitution.
Well, precisely. Under full faith and credit, it is necessary for any state to recognize a valid divorce in any other state, as long as the operative term here is valid. There are instances where, for example, in Nevada, divorces have been obtained on such tenuous grounds that that residents of other states have not been able to benefit from them. But technically, it is essential in a federal union to have the states comprising this union pay attention to what's done legally in the other states. Otherwise, the whole thing fragments. And that's what's going to make this thing just a mess and a half legally. There's no doubt about that. And the only answer to this is either the Massachusetts legislature, in a hurry, makes it impossible for this judicial decision to operate, or there needs to be an amendment to the federal constitution of the United States that will define marriage, in which case no state would be able to do this.
Let's back up here in the few minutes that we have before the break on that very question. Where does marriage get its definition? It's hard for me to say that the state defines it in any real sense, because what the state can define, the state can redefine at some later point. Where do we get the definition of marriage?
Okay, well, if there is no absolute standard for the definition, then our definitions are, of course, relative. And this is the point that I've made in a number of my books, The Law Above the Law, Human Rights and Human Dignity, and so forth, that it's essential to have a word from God defining those things that are transcendent and absolute. If we don't have such a definition, then we are we're up the metaphysical creek without a paddle, and we have tremendous difficulties. If there were an amendment to the U.S. Constitution defining marriage, that would not be the source of the definition. What would happen there is that the country would recognize that there is an underlying standard for this sort of thing, and the Constitution now needs to reflect this because of the social changes that are taking place.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. He is Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He's a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana. He's authored and edited over 50 books, including Christians in the Public Square. Now, when we come back from this break, we're going to need to turn our attention not only to a further discussion of the definition of marriage, but the relationship of marriage to the state. It seems as though, it seems to me, folks, that the Supreme Court of Massachusetts has said that they can define marriage. Now, they want the definition of marriage to be broader than it has been to this point in the state of Massachusetts. And they're going to force, or at least try and force, the legislature's hand. Is it legitimate for the state, on the other hand, to say, no, we do define it, and we'll define it this way? Dr. Montgomery, can we go so far as to say that the state can define marriage in a real sense beyond what you just mentioned, the objective, transcendent definition that only God can give?
Well, the state very definitely has to define marriage for statutory purposes, because otherwise there would be no legal protection for those who are involved in relationships, and most important, the children of such relationships would not have protection. So, yes, the state does have to provide definitions. The issue is not that, really. The issue is, what kind of definitions will the state provide? And will the state defer to the transcendent understanding of marriage, which has been characteristic of the entire Judeo-Christian Western tradition? Now, obviously, that isn't the only definition possible. There are cultures in which marriage is defined in other ways. Among the Mormons, there was, of course, a polygamous understanding of what marriage could constitute, etc. But here we are up against the problem, which is so characteristic of our time, that there is increasing secularization, increasing pluralism, and now you have enough people who don't care at all about the Judeo-Christian understanding of marriage, and who argue that you've got to have definitions for this and all other social issues that will be broad enough to cover anybody and everybody.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. We'll continue our conversation with him after this.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc. International human rights attorney and law professor Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on why he joined the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
I went to Cornell University as a pagan undergraduate. At Cornell, I was converted to biblical Christianity through evangelical witness. Then, before joining a church, I compared the various major doctrinal statements with the Greek New Testament. Amazingly, the Lutheran confessions fitted Scripture exactly, and it was a theology which centered everything on the cross of Christ. The Missouri Synod, with all its human weaknesses, remains the only mainline church which consistently takes a serious view of historic Christian doctrine.
If you want to learn more about the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, call our Issues Etc. resource line at 1-800-737-0172 and ask to receive a free pamphlet called What About the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod? 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The Super Bowl brouhaha is already impacting decision-making at the major networks. ABC, NBC, and CBS are now acting in light of the intense public outcry and a Federal Communications Commission investigation. Stuart Shepard reports.
With the FCC currently investigating the entirety of the halftime show, the fallout is already showing. Industry reports say NBC affiliates are objecting to a Sweeps Month episode of ER. At issue, a scene showing an elderly woman with her upper body exposed. CBS announced it'll add a time delay to the Grammys.
The Recording Academy welcomes you to the 45th Annual Grammy Awards.
To stop any indecent language or images, ABC wants a delay on the Oscars. Dave Haverty, president of Preview Family Movie and TV Review, says public pressure and the investigation get a lot of credit, but advertisers also hold huge power. Take, for example, the NFL.
It would be very serious repercussions to CBS if the NFL canceled their contract with CBS and went someplace else over this.
He says the FCC must act decisively.
If the FCC chooses to do nothing, it just leaves an open door.
Bill Johnson with the American Decency Association says even if the FCC fails, it will not be a time to give up.
The crescendo must just increase, not decrease. The pressure must continue, and we must not falter this time around.
Meantime, he says it's a time for Christians to reconsider the entertainment programming decisions we make in our own homes. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepard.
One other casualty of the halftime show, the Playmakers on ESPN. The sports network is canceling the drama after just one season after catching heat from the NFL over the show's content. You can email your comments on the halftime show to the FCC and your congressman through citizenlink.org. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
AM 850 KFUO is pleased to salute our day sponsor on this Thursday, February 5th, 2004, Mike Pfeiffer. Today's day sponsor has made a contribution to AM 850 KFUO in celebration of his father's birthday. Once again, we say thanks to Mike Pfeiffer of Strasburg, Illinois, today's AM 850 KFUO day sponsor. Issues Etc. is partially underwritten by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of our Book of the Month for February, God's No and God's Yes, the proper distinction between law and gospel. The cost is $9.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, check out our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. God's No and God's Yes. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February.
It is a deeply troubling ruling. We will be reviewing the decision. Activist judges continue to seek to redefine marriage by court order without regard for the will of the people.
Again, that's Scott McClellan, White House Press Secretary, reacting to the Massachusetts Supreme Court decision recently, their clarifying decision regarding gay marriage in that state. We're talking about this issue with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. He's author and editor of more than 50 books, including one that he has authored, Christians in the Public Square. Dr. Montgomery, tell us about this book, Christians in the Public Square.
Well, it consists of about 30 essays dealing with topics of public interest, politics, law, social issues. The point of it is to get the reader to think through these issues from a Christian standpoint and to recognize that the Christian philosophy of life provides far better answers in these areas than any of its competitors.
By the way, folks, you can get more information on the book Christians in the Public Square by our guest, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, on the website for the Canadian Institute for Law, Theology, and Public Policy. If you put those together as an acronym, you will have the website for the Canadian Institute for Law, Theology, and Public Policy, CILTPP.com. It's CILTPP.com. Or you can call them at area code 780-461-3076. That's 780-461-3076. The book is called Christians in the Public Square. Dr. Montgomery, have the judges, at least the four that voted for this, of the Supreme Court of Massachusetts, have they overstepped their judicial authority?
Well, they must make decisions as cases come up to them. So they are performing a proper function in that respect. The problem is the kind of decision that they have made, because there is certainly no precedent within the law of Massachusetts or in federal law for a decision of this kind. The basis that they have used for this is an alleged maintaining of non-discrimination, in other words, a refusal to discriminate. But this is a complete logical misunderstanding of what discrimination is. Discrimination is to take, for example, two like things and treat one of them in one way and the other in another way. Huh? That's how discrimination operates. For example, in the days before the racial revolution in the United States, if you forced blacks to sit at the back of the bus and whites could sit in the front of the bus, but the blacks couldn't, this was unjust discrimination because the whites and the blacks should have exactly equal opportunity to sit anywhere in a bus they wanted to, obviously. Now, if you try to apply that kind of reasoning to the marriage situation, then what you're saying is that the union of two males or the union of two females is exactly the same thing as a marriage between a male and a female, and not, therefore, to allow both of them to use the term marriage is unjust discrimination. But obviously, on any logical ground, on any physiological ground, for goodness sake, males and females are indeed quite different. My chances of having a baby are nil, and my physiological makeup is sufficiently distinct from that of a female that there is no way in the world that these can be placed in the identical category.
So we are not comparing apples to apples.
Correct. Correct. And therefore, discrimination is not an issue here. Not at all. It of course, becomes an issue if, for example, there were a job which could be done equally well by a man and a woman, and the man gets a higher salary for doing this than the woman. That's discrimination. But if, for example, there is a job which physically a woman cannot do, and therefore a man is hired for this job, that is not a matter of discrimination whatsoever. This would be like my attempting, at my age and my general driving ability, to become a jet pilot. And when they refused to allow me to take the training and get my license as a jet pilot, I screamed that this was discrimination because they were allowing other people to do this. The fact of the matter is I do not have the qualities or the ability to do this. And for that reason, I cannot argue discrimination if they refuse to allow me to do it. And if an idiot who can't pass the bar examination says it's discrimination because he isn't given a license to practice law, then he has misunderstood the whole thing.
Is this an example of, and the term of art now here is judicial activism, is this an example of judicial activism on the part of the Massachusetts Supreme Court?
Well, yes, it undoubtedly does have to be classified that way, and the reason is that this goes against the entire Western legal tradition, and the judges are supposed to uphold existing law and pay a great deal of attention to precedents. The idea is not to think that they are themselves a kind of higher-level legislature that is able to make law. And it's very interesting. Here in England, judges are much more conservative in this regard. They defer to Parliament. They do not feel that their function is to substitute for the will of the people. Whereas in the United States, there has been a long tradition, ever since the onset of American legal realism with Carl Llewellyn and other legal philosophers, to make the law for the judge to say to himself, well, legislature is rather slow. What we need is to move society along, and I can do this by way of my decision-making. Roe versus Wade is an abominable example of that kind of thing.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. We're talking about gay marriage. If you have a question or a comment on gay marriage, give us a call in the next 20 minutes. That's how much longer we'll be talking with him about this. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, tell me if I'm misreading the situation in Massachusetts, Dr. Montgomery. It looks as though the Supreme Court has essentially directed the legislature to pass a law of some kind. Can a Supreme Court direct a legislature to pass a law?
Not at all. They can, of course, say, as in many legal decisions, that it's unfortunate that the legislature has not acted. If the legislature would act, it would clear up a muddy area of the law. That kind of statement is made continually. It's made over here. The House of Lords, the English Court of Appeals, in their decisions will often say that they are bound to the situation as it stands, and there are certain areas that need rectification. That's fine. But for a court to rule in the manner in which the Massachusetts Supreme Court has ruled and then to say that the legislature had better pay attention to this is utterly foolish. The legislature should tell the court to go hang itself, and the legislature should deal with this thing as the representatives believe that they are properly representing the people and representing the values that the state and the country maintain.
This seems to be an epidemic in the United States, from state to state, at the federal level as well. We hear all about judicial activism or legislating from the bench. Is there something inherently flawed in the legal and the court system of the United States?
Well, the American system is based upon the separation of powers. The executive, the president or the governor, is supposed to act as an administrator, okay? A leader and an administrator. The legislature is supposed to pass the laws, and the court, the judicial branch, is supposed to, as we say in England, vet or check these laws against the legal tradition, and principally, where there's a written constitution, against the written constitution, to make sure that those laws are legitimate. Now, things work very nicely if people do their job. Things get really messy when there's an encroachment of one branch of government on another. In the 18th century, Montesquieu, the French political philosopher, stressed the necessity of having this kind of separation of powers and having it a clean separation. You can't completely separate these elements, but they need to be separated as much as is possible. If, for example, the president or the governor begins to take all power into his hands, then government can fall into a dictatorship. If you have the parliament or the legislature attempting to do everything, then you're going to have what the Lord Hailsham called an elective dictatorship, and the end result is going to be anarchy. Bedlam and anarchy. Democracy is going to degenerate into anarchy. And when the courts try to take over the legislative function, the result of this is that you lose democracy as well, because the judges are not elected. They don't represent the people. They are appointed, and often they are appointed for life. so that they are able to make decisions that that can't be questioned at all. There isn't any opportunity to engage in a responsible reversal of the decisions that they've made.
Our call-in numbers, 505-780-1800-730-2727. Joe's calling from his car. Joe, thank you for waiting, and welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks. I just tuned in a little bit ago, so I don't know what all you covered. And been talking about this with a lot of people, and the argument that I have against it, you know, would be what they contribute to society as to why they would deserve any special benefits other than what an individual would have, which I think I kind of heard coming out. But then I got to thinking that if we use that as the main basis for opposing it, as cloning's coming on the horizon and a homosexual couple says, well, we can bring another individual into this world as a part of our union. I'm just, no answers. I'm just curious if anybody had really thought about that, or if it's heading for a trap for using the argument that the reason not to give them special rights is because they really don't contribute to society by bringing, you know, next generation into being.
Dr. Montgomery, your response
well,
to Joe's thoughts?
I don't think that we should approach it that way, because if we do this on a benefits analysis, for example, then we might argue that elderly couples would not have a right to get married because they are too old to have children. I think that that we should probably approach this in terms of whether or not a quasi-permanent union of this kind is in any way equivalent to marriage as it has always been understood in the Western tradition, and carrying it on beyond that, if there is a revelational standard, if there is an absolute standard that tells us what a family should consist of, and we pay no attention to this, we fly in the face of it, then what are the consequences of this? What's going to happen under those circumstances? I think that sort of analysis would probably be more helpful.
Dr. Montgomery, let's go back to the phones here. Paul is on the line. Paul, he's calling from High Ridge. Paul, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. I just wanted to make the comment that not that many years ago, homosexuality was considered a psychiatric disorder. It's well documented in the textbooks as to many of the causality of the problem, and somewhere over time, it was taken out of the book, so to speak, as a disorder, and it became an accepted alternate lifestyle. I have seen over the course of my life, professional life, so much harm caused by homosexuality, not only to the individuals themselves, but to society at large, that it boggles the mind to think of what they've done in Massachusetts.
Paul, thank you for the call. Your thoughts, Dr. Montgomery?
Yes, I think that this is another illustration of the fact that that psychiatry and psychology constitute soft sciences and not hard sciences. And when they maintained that homosexuality was indeed a disorder, they didn't have sufficiently solid evidence for this. They were picking up philosophical ideas, which were correct, philosophical and religious ideas, which were correct. They were living off of inherited capital. But because those fields are so sloshy, in the way in which they make their judgments, it was easy for the field to shift in the current direction, again, not on the basis of evidence at all, but on the basis that the fields of psychiatry and psychology pick up from other realms their value system. The value system doesn't come from psychological science in itself. The value system comes from elsewhere, and then there is a certain rationalization that goes on. I don't believe that we should seek the final answers in that realm at all. It's also a shame, I think, that Christians who have realized the evils of homosexuality have not done the kind of rigorous sociological studies that could show very definitely the aberrational nature of the phenomenon, and that should have been done, and it hasn't been done. And as a result of this, the homosexual is still able to argue that this is something genetic, which is ridiculous. I mean, even if it were, for goodness sake, that wouldn't mean that it was any less wrong. I mean, if I am genetically inclined to alcoholism, as I understand American Indians tend to be, that doesn't make alcoholism any less wrong. It simply means that I have a tendency in a direction that I'm going to have to control. And the same thing goes as far as homosexuality is concerned.
Herman is calling from Illinois. Herman, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask Dr. Montgomery, in the 1890s, the United States Supreme Court made a ruling in relationship to a case with Mormon polygamy or plural marriage that in the United States, marriage was defined as between one man and one woman. In relationship to these issues over homosexual marriage and these other rulings, where does the definition given in that ruling still stand in terms of stature today?
Excellent question.
Yes, that's good. Yes, in Reynolds versus the United States, that's exactly what the Supreme Court ruled. It said that if Mormons wanted to believe in plural marriage on the basis of their religious convictions, they could certainly do so. But if they practiced it, they would go to jail. That case, of course, remains. The problem is that the Supreme Court can overrule its past decisions. The Supreme Court of the United States can. It is remarkable that the Massachusetts Supreme Court, which is a state Supreme Court, paid no attention to this, for goodness sake. Now, it's true that those cases have come under criticism on the ground that the cases did not sufficiently take into account religious freedom. But the criticisms have been those of critical legal studies people, liberals in the area of philosophy of law, and the fact of the matter is that you have got to have a clean definition of marriage in order to have a stable society. And the polygamy issue, it seems to me, was correctly decided by the Supreme Court of the United States.
One more quick phone call while we wrap up our conversation with Dr. John Warren Montgomery. Matt is calling from Richmond Heights. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Todd. Dr. Montgomery, what recommendation do you have with regard to how we should take care of judges who are making rulings that are ungodly and evil?
Thank you.
Well, I would ask myself how they ever became judges in the first place, because they are appointed in virtually all instances rather than being elected. And if they're appointed, they were certainly appointed by somebody. And how did those who appointed them get into office? Here I have a chance to rant and rave at the very end of this program on how desperately important it is to place intelligent Christian believers in positions of political influence. The fact of the matter is that evangelical Christians are always yelling and screaming about the evil politicians and the incompetent judges and the rest of it. But evangelical Christians don't take the trouble to go to law school to study political science. Instead, they're going on conferences dealing with the pre-tribulation rapture and evolution, things that have happened either so far in the past or so far or that will happen in the future, that they can avoid the problems of the present. What we ought to be doing is attempting to impact our society by getting the very best possible people in political office. If we did, if we had more people like Bush, I mean, his rhetoric is ghastly, but he certainly does have a fine value system. If we had people like him in positions of appointing judges, and we had congressmen who saw the value of such appointments, then we wouldn't have these problems, or we'd have far fewer of them.
Dr. Montgomery, finally, How do Christians make their case in the public square against gay marriage?
Well, it seems to me that what we have to do is to emphasize the de facto differences between men and women, and we do this by emphasizing the positive qualities that each sex has, and we don't want to see those positive qualities disappear in an attempt to blend the sexes. If we emphasize this, I think we make the strongest possible argument. We should also show the illogic of the homosexual marriage position, which is very easy to do. Remember my analogy early in the program about marrying a hippopotamus, for goodness sake? There's no reason why I can't do this if we can define marriage in any way we want. We should emphasize the need for maturity, recognizing facts as they actually are. We should do far more research to show that homosexuality is an aberration and to show the negative consequences of it. One of our callers said that he had seen over his career so many of these negative consequences, but we need to be able to provide a more objective basis to demonstrate this.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, thank you again for being our guest.
You're most welcome. It's always a great pleasure.
Our guest, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, is Director and Professor in Residence for the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. It's held annually in Strasbourg, France. Now, it is too late to attend this summer's Academy. They're all full, but you can register early for 2005. Now, if you'd like a free information brochure on the 9th Annual European Summer Study of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, call 1-800-737-0172. It's our automated resource line, 1-800-737-0172. Ask for that brochure, and we'll send it to you absolutely free. 1-800-737-0172. I love the point he made there at the end. That was marvelous. We can sit there and foment about this all day long. But in the end, you know, we might be better off with a few people pursuing a legal career and maybe the bench themselves. We would. You say, well, if I were a judge, I'd never legislate from the bench. Well, then, for heaven's sakes, pay for your kid to go to law school so that they can be that judge that won't do that. Yeah, I think it's worth it. It's a great service to your country. Christians, we are masters at complaining. And complaining that nothing ever gets done. Here's a good opportunity to put our money and our time and our resources right where it's a long-term solution. It's a long-term solution, but it's a good solution nonetheless. Now, when we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Dr. David Adams here in Studio A about Jacob. The church calendar this day is dedicated to the patriarch Jacob. We'll find out who he was when we come back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.